And it's great to have your company here on Noongar Radio 100.9 FM on your dial. Jodie Hoffman with you for our fortnightly program of Law Matters, which is produced and presented by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Hope you can stay tuned. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk about scams, and particular scams that are being targeted at some of our Aboriginal communities throughout this state. We're also talking with Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services at the Aboriginal Legal Service of WA, about what happens when a mentally impaired person comes into contact with the criminal justice system and what are the options with regards to their imprisonment if that is deemed the necessary steps to take. We're also talking about Aboriginal sentencing courts because Victoria has just opened up its 11th Koori Court, and it's great for Victoria that more of these community courts are opening up. But what's happening here in Western Australia? Peter Collins will chat with us very shortly here on Law Matters. Do stay tuned. You're tuned to Law Matters, brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. And don't forget, our program is broadcast here on Noongar Radio in Perth, but also repeated on the National Indigenous Radio Service on alternate Tuesdays. Well, disability advocates are calling for an urgent review of the case of an Aboriginal man who was indefinitely jailed without trial since 2003 under laws for the mentally impaired. And at the time of his imprisonment, he was 14 years old. Now, we're not talking about that particular case today because the sad reality is that that is not a standalone case. So we're going to talk about the broader implications of what actually happens when somebody is imprisoned who is mentally impaired. And to clarify that situation for us, welcome to the program, Peter Collins, who is the Director of Legal Services at the Aboriginal Legal Service in Perth. Pete, thank you for your time on the program.
No worries, Jodie. How are you going?
I'm very good. Now, I'm presuming, Pete, that as the head of the criminal unit across all of our 15 offices throughout Western Australia, somebody who has been in prison for over 10 years under the mentally impaired section of the Act is not a standalone case, is it?
No, it's not. It's a huge issue, Jodie. There are increasing numbers of Aboriginal people who are being unfit to go to trial, and a lot of those people find themselves ending up in jail under what are called custody orders. So it's a huge issue.
I understand that the figures are 32% of all mentally impaired people detained indefinitely are Aboriginal. That is huge, isn't it?
It is, and that's the highest percentage of any cultural group within the community. So the majority of people who have been found unfit, who are in custody and they're in jails at the moment, are Aboriginal people, which is awful, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise.
So what does happen when somebody falls into this category, Pete, and goes through the court system, is found guilty and are then sentenced? What happens to that person, and how is their journey into imprisonment guided through different acts?
Well, in actual fact, they're not found guilty nor sentenced, Jade, because what happens is that they're found unfit to actually undergo the court process. And that'll arise because of a cognitive impairment, an intellectual disability, things of that nature, and increasingly for clients of ALSWA, clients suffering from fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So if they're found unfit, the process under the Act is that either the charges are dismissed absolutely, so the person walks out of the court with nothing hanging over their head. That's one option. The other option is the court imposes a custody order, which means under the current situation, the person is locked up in a jail and potentially indefinitely, which is what appears to have occurred with this poor boy who was found unfit all those years ago when he was 14 years of age. So there's sort of no in-between situation. You can't be released back into the community under some sort of supervision order. it's all or nothing. Either you walk out the door with nothing, or you get locked up and you face the prospect of being locked up indefinitely, especially if the impairment you're suffering from is one that's untreatable, and a number of these sorts of conditions are.
Which would indicate that prison's not really the right sort of place for that person anyway.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, prisons are places for people who are either serving sentences of imprisonment because they've been convicted of offences, or for people who've been refused bail and are on remand, awaiting to have their cases dealt with by the courts. It's not a place for people who haven't been found guilty of an offence, aren't guilty of any criminal act, who, by virtue of some sort of medical condition, aren't fit to go to court. They're being warehoused in Western Australia in jails, and jails aren't the right places for these people. There doesn't appear to be the right facilities to help them in terms of medical and other facilities. And as the case of this boy who was 14 when he was unfit shows, and other notorious cases show, people can languish in jail for incredibly lengthy periods of time, which is, you know, utterly inhumane and totally inappropriate.
Because, of course, it's not going to have any rehabilitative sort of outcomes, is it? It's basically, it's an untreatable condition. They're in there and that's just where they're staying.
But look, that's the case with a lot of these conditions. That's correct. Some of these, for example, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is, for all intents and purposes, untreatable. So, in other words, you don't get better. And that means the person, if what happens with the Act is that there are reviews done by the Mentally Impaired Defendants Review Board, which is an arm of government. And if your condition doesn't get better, it occurs to me self-evidently that you're going to have a pretty stern assignment ahead of you, persuading the board that the situation's changed such that you're no longer a problem or a danger or whatever it may be, to warrant you being let back into the community.
So what are the other options that are available, Pete, and who can determine whether a person has stayed imprisoned long enough?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that need to be looked at, and pretty urgently, because this isn't a problem that's going to go away, and it's just an awful scenario that people are going to be being locked up for really lengthy periods of time, much longer than you would be if you're actually found guilty and sentenced to a term of imprisonment. And the case of the boy who was 14 is a perfect example of that. I think the Act needs to be reviewed and amended to enable courts to release people under supervision back into the community with the supports they need to keep them on track. I think reviews of people who are locked up need to be done by the courts, not by government, so the process is transparent, and that would also entail the person being able to be represented by a lawyer, for example, the ALS. So the ALS can advocate on behalf of the person, because at the moment their capacity to do that's very limited if the government's reviewing it via the board. And those reviews need to be on a regular basis, for example, perhaps on a 12-monthly basis. And the other thing is, there needs to be a secure facility created for people who are found unfit. At the moment, there's a plan to put that facility out at Caversham, which has generated a lot of controversy. But that's for people with cognitive impairments. There may be other people who are currently locked up who haven't got a cognitive impairment but are unfit for another reason. And as I understand the situation, they run the risk of remaining in jail.
All right. And it really is effectively just warehousing people, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And look, to get back to the issue of FASD, you know, FASD is a huge problem in Western Australia, as it is across the country, especially, unfortunately, for Aboriginal people. FASD arises, as you know, in a situation where the mother of the person has been drinking alcohol, and usually too much alcohol, while they were pregnant with that person. As I mentioned a moment ago, it's not treatable. the problem is underdiagnosed, but there are increasingly more people coming before the courts who are diagnosed with FASD, who have been found unfit, and where ALS is getting kids as young as 11 years old who are being found unfit. Now, they mightn't necessarily get a custody order, but the issue is they go back into terribly disadvantaged communities where there aren't the desperately needed supports and assistance available to them. They reoffend and they run the risk ultimately of getting a custody order and being locked up indefinitely. Now, that's a pretty unpalatable prospect for someone who's got a condition which has nothing to do with any fault by them.
I'm speaking with Peter Collins, the Director of Legal Services at the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Pete, we'll leave that part of it there, but I would recommend to people that if you wanted to find out more about fetal alcohol syndrome, there's an incredible documentary that was made by community members up north in Western Australia called Tristan, and really incredible insight into the effects of that condition. Pete, we'll come back in a moment. We're going to be talking about Aboriginal sentencing courts here on Law Matters.
The Reading Writing Hotline is there to help adults who have difficulties with reading, writing or spelling. Their number is 1300 655 06.
1300 655 06.
Go on, take the plunge.
This is a community service announcement from Noongar Radio.
And you're with Law Matters on Noongar Radio, brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of WA. My guest, Peter Collins, Director of Legal Services. Now, Pete, a hot topic always that we've spent a lot of time discussing at the Aboriginal Legal Service is Aboriginal sentencing courts. And interesting to note that in Victoria last week, the Attorney-General, Robert Clark, joined the President of the Children's Court, Judge Peter Cousins, to open the Dandenong Children's Koori Court over in Victoria, which is in fact the 11th Children's Koori Court in Victoria. That's a great feat, isn't it, to have 11 Koori Courts in Victoria? Something's working, isn't it?
Oh, look, you're right, Jodie, and it's a fantastic innovation. And the interesting thing is these courts are being opened. There was another court opened earlier this year in August in Victoria, in Heidelberg, in the northwest of Melbourne. And as you say, there are now 11 children's Koori courts in Victoria, and many more adult courts in both the Magistrates Court and also in the County Court, which is the equivalent of our District Court. And the Koori Court concept is being embraced by both sides of politics in Victoria because, as we know, the government there at the moment is a Liberal government, so it's a Conservative government. It's got a strong law and order agenda, but they've still been able to embrace Koori courts. And the Attorney-General said in opening the Dandenong Children's Koori Court that the Koori courts had been a success in achieving improved outcomes for Koori youth and the broader community, helped to reduce reoffending and turn offenders away from crime, and that they were a key element of the Aboriginal Justice Agreement in Victoria, which was described as the Victorian Government's blueprint for reducing the over-representation of Aboriginal people within the justice system, both as offenders and victims.
Now, for those not familiar with this type of court model, the Koori courts involve elders and respected persons sitting with the magistrate as part of a discussion about an appropriate sentence. The magistrate then determines and imposes the sentence, and they have been successful throughout Victoria. You wouldn't have 11 of them if they weren't doing something right. And it engages Aboriginal communities within the justice system, and it's definitely not a soft option, Peter, some people would suggest, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. And at the end of the day, it's the decision for the judge or the magistrate as to what they do with the Koori person, and you can still go to jail. So it by no means is it a soft option. And when you include in that the elders will often admonish the Koori person over what they've done, and they'd be... Some of them are terribly shamed by what they hear from the elders. And there's an additional punishment aspect, if you like, to a Koori court, which you won't get from a mainstream court sentencing someone. So, and the other important aspect about it is the Victorian government has made a real commitment to properly resourcing these courts. So I was lucky enough a couple of years ago to go over to watch the Koori court in action in Shepparton in regional Victoria, and every single agency which might have had some involvement with the Koori offender in that case, you know, from housing, employment, alcohol and drugs, sport and rec, you name it, they were all at the table and they were all Aboriginal faces. So there was an effort and a real one to ensure that the whole process was culturally appropriate. In that particular, the case that I watched involved a young Koori lad who'd committed a very serious assault outside a nightclub. By the skin of his teeth, he avoided jail, but the feedback I've received since then, and this was several years ago, is that after that Koori court appearance, that young Koori lad has not been back in trouble. So, you know, these courts go a long way to reducing reoffending and, in turn, the terrible numbers of Aboriginal people locked up in jails.
It's refreshing, Pete, to hear that Victoria is adapting to models that are working. They're going into it in a collaborative approach. Both sides of politics agree that it's working. In their 8 adult and 11 kids Koori courts, they employ 19 Aboriginal people with an additional 80 elders and respected persons assisting the court. That'd be awesome if it happened here in WA, wouldn't it?
Oh, look, WA is crying out for properly rolled out and resourced Aboriginal sentencing courts. And, you know, we're in the dark ages in comparison to places like Victoria with this sort of thing. There's a real risk, I think, that the community courts, as they're called, in the goldfields will be defunded and collapse. And if that happens, there'll be no Aboriginal sentencing courts whatsoever in Western Australia, which will be a complete disgrace. And we've got to do better over here. I mean, we have the highest rates of Aboriginal imprisonment, as everyone well knows, in the country. The rate of juvenile detention in this state is absolutely disgusting. And there's got to be a better way forward. And sure to goodness, if Victoria is anything to go by, the establishment of an equivalent Koori court set up here in WA should be trialled, but done properly with the proper resources, that appropriate cultural context with Aboriginal faces around the table, not only the elders, proper supports and assistance to the elders to be able to undertake the role, all sorts of things, you know, an Aboriginal interpreter service at the table if need be. On it goes, but this government doesn't appear to be interested. Gives lip service to its concerns about the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in jails and juvenile detention centres, and just continues on its merry way with this law and order dive to the bottom, being tougher and tougher on crime.
11 Koori courts in Victoria. How many Aboriginal sentencing courts here in WA?
2.
Throughout the whole state?
Correct.
No statewide interpreter service?
None.
Different communities, language, everything throughout Western Australia, with the most serious of offences coming down to Perth and taking people out of country as well.
Correct. And look, on that score, Jodie, it's worth noting that the only real interpreter service in WA is the Kimberley Interpreter Service, and they're funded by the state and federal government. Their overall budget is paltry. Their interpreters and staff are employed the same as a young kid who works on a checkout at a supermarket. The Kimberley Interpreter Service has recently been told by the state government that the state government is going to withdraw all of its funding, about $200,000 a year. The information that's been provided to KIS is the government is of the view that there is no need for Aboriginal interpreters and justice system because Aboriginal people can speak English adequate to be able to understand what's going on. Now, if that's the case, that is a disgrace. It is profoundly wrong and it should be redressed. And if you can't bring yourself to enable people to be able to properly understand court proceedings when they're going to jail, and as you say, serious offences for lengthy periods of time by providing an interpreter service to Aboriginal people when needed, what are we coming to?
It's mind-blowing, actually, when you think about it, Pete. It really is. And I'm wanting to know, through your long involvement within WA's justice system, how important would Aboriginal sentencing courts being embraced in this state be to stopping that reoffending that continually happens?
Well, look at it from this point of view. The rates of Aboriginal reoffending, if you've been to jail as an Aboriginal male, the stats are up around about 80% likely that you'll return to jail. And the numbers for Aboriginal females are increasing, although not at that extent as well. So if you go in to jail, very likely that you're going to return to jail further down the track. Now what that means inevitably is not only do people get tied up for lengthy periods of time in custody, but there are also more victims of crime. There are more victims of crime in the wider community, but also in Aboriginal communities as well, as we know. So there are no winners in that, and the financial cost to the community is phenomenal. It's an expensive process to lock people up. And my view is properly resourced Aboriginal sentencing courts has got to be a realistic alternative to that sort of scenario. If they do reduce rates of reoffending, if they do properly engage offenders and their communities in dealing with offending, it's an experiment worth trying, rather than just turning your back on it and saying we're not going to go there because it's all too hard.
All right. Now, obviously, there are going to be cuts to Aboriginal legal services around the country, as was announced in the federal budget. Do you see the situation for Aboriginal courts changing here in Western Australia?
No, I don't. I'm pretty cynical and pessimistic about things. Under the current government, I can't see any meaningful change being embraced, let alone implemented. I think things will get worse rather than better. And with the funding cuts, despite everything that the federal government has said to date, the funding cuts will affect our capacity to represent Aboriginal people in court on a daily basis. It's inevitable that we will have a lesser presence in the courts, and the risk there is that people, more and more people, are going to be going to jail. There's no two ways about it. They can sugarcoat it as much as they like, but that's what will happen.
And we've already got disgraceful figures here in the West of over-representation of our mob within prisons and the court system. And I would imagine that those rates decline somewhat in Victoria, where Koori courts have been embraced.
Yes, that's right.
All right, Pete Collins, thank you so much for your time and chatting with us today on the program. Appreciate it.
No worries, Jody. Good on you. Thank you.
Peter Collins is the Director of Legal Services at the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, talking there about Aboriginal sentencing courts. And just so that you're more aware of how they do work, in order to be sentenced in the Children's Koori Court, a young person who is an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person must plead guilty to or be found guilty of a charge and be willing to come to court and talk about their offending and its context. The court does not hear sexual offences cases or breaches of intervention orders. And great employment for Aboriginal people through that collaborative approach in Western Australia. And good on you, Victoria. The 11th Koori Court just opened up last week. You're on Noongar Radio 100.9 FM. We're going to be talking about scams shortly here on Law Matters. Do stay tuned. And coming up very shortly here on the program, chatting with Delia Rickard, who is the Deputy Chair of the ACCC. We're going to be talking about some scams that are making their way through regional Western Australia. This is Law Matters, brought to you by the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Jodie Hoffman with you this hour. Good to have your company. And an important area we're going to talk about that affects, if not us personally, certainly somebody that we know throughout their life where you get targeted by a scam. Now, some of these scams are so clever, and it's certainly no shame to fall for one of these scams, because they are very cleverly disguised to try and rip people off. So it does happen to anyone and everyone. So we thought we'd touch base with the ACCC and find out if there are particular scams that are targeting Aboriginal communities at the moment. And joining us on the line is Delia from the ACCC, and sorry, I've just moved my paper. Delia Rickard is the Deputy Chair of the ACCC over in Sydney, and she joins us on the line. Delia, thank you for your time. How are you?
I'm very well, Jodie. It's a pleasure. And thanks for covering this, because it's really important. These scammers are getting people right across Australia, and it's great to have the opportunity to talk to people about it.
Delia, before we go and talk about some particular scams, tell us what the ACCC is and its role.
We're the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. So our role is to make markets work, is the shorthand. But it's to ensure that there's competition in the marketplace, so that you have lots of choices of different goods in the same category, and that there's competition that will drive prices down. And the other part of our role is really to protect consumers, to make sure that the goods they buy are safe, to make sure that the goods or the services they get do what they're meant to do, and to give you rights such as refunds if things don't work properly, and to make sure that industry's honest with you, so that people can't mislead you or trick you by telling you that something costs one thing and then charge you a lot more, or that something does a particular thing that it doesn't. So it's to keep the market honest, to ensure that consumers get good value for their money and they can believe what they hear in ads.
Some people feel a bit embarrassed if they get ripped off, but that's the whole way that scams work, isn't it? They're cleverly disguised to make us believe that it's too good to be true.
That's exactly right, and it's big business for the scammers, and they are very, very clever, and I do a lot of work around scams, and I meet people of all age groups, all backgrounds, all nationalities who've been caught by scams, and in fact, often I look at something and we'll be not quite sure whether it's a scam or not. So, as you say, there's no shame in being caught, but it would be so much better to be aware of the signs and know what not to do so that you can avoid them.
Now, the top three scams that Indigenous consumers have reported to ScamWatch this year are government or business affiliation scams, scammers claiming to represent a well-known and trusted organisation with false claims that they are entitled to money, phishing scams with scammers phishing for personal details or money, or online shopping scams with scammers taking people for a ride when buying or selling online. Now, these are areas that obviously we're doing more online shopping. You're meant to, obviously, if you're in remote and regional areas of the state, you're more likely to shop that way. Is there a lot of Aboriginal people that do report scams to you?
Look, so far this year we've had about 416 people report scams to us, and they've lost over $500,000. We've also been working with a community that scammers tried to get millions out of, but the community got smart, and was smart, and spoke to us first to see if it was or wasn't a scam. And
what was that one?
This was promises of big riches, but you have to pay the money to get the money. Oh. And a lot of these scams work on promising you something fabulous, but you have to pay something to get it. It's what we call an advance fee fraud. So a lot of the scams, which we call government or business affiliation scams, or reclaim scams, will pretend to be a trusted, well-known entity. So they could say that they're the Australian Tax Office and you're owed a tax refund. But, you know, due to cutbacks and everything else, there's now a processing or administrative fee, and they'll ask you to pay them some money to get the money they say is owing to you. And they'll often ask you to do that via Western Union or a wire transfer. The fact of the matter is, no government department, no utility like your energy company or your telephone company, and no bank or financial institution is ever going to ask you to pay them money to get money that's actually yours. And if you remember that, you won't get caught. But they're very clever. So at the moment, for instance, they're pretending to be the federal government, and they're calling people saying that now that the carbon tax is gone, people are entitled, that person's entitled to a refund, and they'll say it's, you know, $7,000-something, probably more than you spent on your whole energy bill last year. But again, you have to pay some money to get the money. And one poor woman the other day, her daughter called up, and, you know, she'd lost several thousand dollars already to the scam.
Oh. That's terrible, isn't it?
It's really shocking, really shocking. And what we often find, older people are the victims of this, in part because they're at home and get the phone calls. So it's just worth remembering, nobody... Well, you should ask you to pay money to get money that's actually yours.
Do you find that there are a lot of Aboriginal communities who are targeted by scammers?
Look, we are seeing it more and more. A lot of the scams that are targeting them are scams that are also doing the rest of the communities. We've seen a few ones which have concerned us where it seemed a community was specifically being targeted and preyed upon. And so it is, and often if they are targeting a particular community, they'll go for the traditional owners, the shire or council officers, so the leaders in the community. And so it's worth leaders in communities being aware that they could be targeted with some outlandish story. But, you know, ask yourself, is it too good to be true? If they're really going to do this for me, why do I have to pay them some money first off? We saw a big inheritance scam in the Northern Territory last year where somebody was contacted and told that they'd inherited a large amount of money, but there were legal fees and taxes that needed to be paid before they could get it. And we think in that instance quite a lot of money was actually lost to that scam. So if you remember that basic rule, that's a very good starting point. And at the ACCC, we're always happy to, people want to call us and say, do you think this is real or not? We're happy to talk to you about it. But one of the other things for people to remember is scammers will often say, oh, look, you can check this out. This is our email address or this is our phone number. Just give us a call. You can speak to my boss and they'll tell you that this is all legitimate. You'll be calling the scammer back or one of the scammer's partners. So always if you want to check something out, either give the ACCC a call or call, if they say they're Telstra, for instance, look up Telstra in the telephone book or do an online search, get their real number and call them and check.
Do we know if the scammers are operating from within or outside of Australia?
Look, there clearly are some scammers operating from within Australia, but the vast majority seem to be operating from overseas.
I'd like to talk, Delia, about some more specific examples of scams that have been doing the rounds in Western Australia.
Sure. Oh, you're asking me. One of the ones we're seeing a lot of at the moment is what we call the Telstra scam. And so you pick up the phone and the person on the other end tells you they're a Telstra technician and that your computer's infected with a terrible virus. They need you to give them access to your computer and that they can fix it for you for a modest charge, $9 or $10. What happens if you agree to this is you will end up downloading what we call malware onto your computer, and that can give scammers access to all your private information, or it could start encrypting files and really stuff your computer up in a big way. And they'll ask you for your credit card details just so they can charge you the $9 or $10. But what you'll find is that a lot more than $9 or $10 goes out of your account. So that's been one that's been targeting WA and elsewhere. Another one that we're seeing emerge everywhere is what we call the Qantas Virgin scam, and people answer the phone and they get a recorded voice sounding saying, congratulations, thanks for flying Qantas or thanks for flying Virgin recently. And because lots of people do fly these days, they think, oh, it might be true. You know, we'd like to give you a reward for flying with us, $999 worth of money for your next trip. Press 1. And if you press 1, somebody will answer the phone and they'll start asking for all of this really private information about you. They might want your bank account details, your Medicare number, your passport number, your tax file number. And the important message here is never, ever give away your important personal private information to somebody who calls you out of the blue. Because what those people do is they then package that information up about you, and there are computer systems out there that can match, package that with other information some other scammer might have got about you, and then they sell that on so that others can pretend to be you, run up bills in your name so they can contact you and scam you. So it's really important you get one of those calls, just hang up.
And, of course, that would be leading to identity theft as well, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. They use it so they can pretend to be you. They might open utility bills. somehow they might get around the point checks to open a financial account and run up debts in your names. And one of the things we suggest more and more to people now that identity theft is a problem that we're all living with is you can get a free copy of your credit record once a year, and it's worth every year looking at your credit record to make sure that anything that's there does relate to you and that it's not somebody out there running up bills in your name and giving you a very bad credit record.
You're tuned to Law Matters on 100.9 FM Noongar Radio. Delia Rickard is my guest. She is the ACCC Deputy Chair. Delia, with Aboriginal community members being targeted with a lot of these scams, is there any redress if you do get ripped off? Like, do people ever get their money back?
It's very rare, really very rare indeed. With some of the online shopping ones, it may be possible where there's a credit card process, because we started talking about online shopping at the beginning of this, and we're seeing through some of the, you know, the auction sales sites where people can put their goods up for sale, two sorts of things happening. One, people say that they have goods for sale, but they're travelling or something, so you need to send them the money before they'll send you the goods. And you send the money and you never receive the goods. Now, that was done by a credit card and the person's traceable. You might be able to get what we call a chargeback. But mostly, once the money's paid, it's gone forever. And usually scammers will ask you to pay via either one of the Load and Go cards you can now get from the post office or via Western Union or one of the wire transfer companies, because these are very, very difficult to trace and almost impossible to get the money back from.
All right. So I guess the important message that we do want to get out to people is that if you think you have been scammed, do not be shame about it. It's packaged very, very cleverly, and it's important that you do contact the ACCC and let them know. And you can even sort of get information, so much information on the website about scams that are going round to different communities. How can we better protect ourselves, Delia? Because I know that in this modern world of social technology, we're handing out our details left, right and centre through social media, online shopping, a whole range of areas. What are some key points that we can do to protect ourselves from the likelihood of being scammed?
First of all, never give away your personal information to someone who calls you out of the blue. And even when you're shopping and they ask you questions, ask yourself, do they really need this piece of information? If you've got a computer, it's really important to keep the up-to-date antivirus, anti-spam software on it and get that from a reputable dealer, not a cheapest thing off the internet, and have a good firewall. Be sceptical. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't true. Anyone who ever asks you to wire the money via something like Western Union, just don't do it. That, to me, that's the greatest sign that something's going to be a scam. And be on the alert. I think those are some of the really important things. And if you ever want to check if something's legitimate, don't use the contact details provided by the person you're dealing with. Go and independently source them and check on that. So can I tell people about two really good sources of information? The ACCC's got a terrific Indigenous Facebook page called ACCC Your Rights Mob, and there's lots of information there about scams. And there's also the main scamwatch.gov.au site where you can sign up for tweets or emails, whatever your preference, where you get the latest information on all the scams during the rounds, how to identify them, avoid them, and what to do if you have been scammed, which makes me think that I should also remind people, if you think you've given away your bank account details to a scammer, get in contact with your bank straight away and tell them so they can stop money being taken out, or your Medicare number or any other personal information that links to something like that. Get in contact and tell them so that you can make sure nobody's using it improperly.
Great advice for us on the program today, Delia Rickard. Thank you so much for having a chat with us here on Noongar Radio, and just reminding people that if someone approaches you or your community with an offer that seems too good to be true, say no and walk away. And if you think you have fallen victim to a scam, don't be shame. Report it to the ACCC through the Indigenous hotline on 1300 303 143. That number again, 1300 303 143. Give us your website, Delia, so that people can check out all the scams that are doing the rounds.
It's scamwatch, scamwatch.gov.au.
Good on you, Delia. Hope we can have a chat again before too long. Thanks for all your great tips today.
Thank
on
you,
the
Jo.
Program.
Love to chat again. Take
Bye
care.
Now.
Bye.
Delia Rickard there, the Deputy Chair of the ACCC, with some really good advice for us. Hey, we're just about out of time on Noongar Radio, the Law Matters program for this week, but thank you for your company. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we look forward to you joining us again in 2 weeks' time. A reminder that if you do need any legal advice or information, check out the website of the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, www.als.org.au. We have 15 offices throughout the state, and we have a toll-free number for the cost of a local call here in Western Australia, and you can call us on that as well. All the information's on our website. From me, Jodie Hoffman, thank you for your time. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks.